Destination Z. Planning route 2. Hackney Down Station. Hackney. London.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we bring you the voice of Mike Africa Jr., a member of the Philadelphia-based MOVE organization. He tackles issues of mass incarceration, police brutality, environmental protection, and systemic oppression. Also, Dr. Malina Abdullah, the founder and coordinator of Black Lives Matter LA on defunding the police in communities and in public schools. That is for our ongoing series, Campaigners for Black Lives. For our weekly Earth Watch, we speak with Dr. Lauren Gifford, a human environment geographer exploring the intersections of global climate change policy, conservation, markets, and justice. Our discussion includes carbon offsets. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Administration officials will provide a classified briefing with the so-called Group of Eight congressional leaders today about the intelligence assessment that Russia offered bounties for killing U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth is a former military pilot wounded in Iraq. She said President Trump has abdicated his responsibility to confront Russian President Vladimir Putin over the charges.
This president has known about these bounties. It has been collaborated through multiple intelligence sources, and he's done nothing. He's allowed the Taliban to carry out the orders of the Russian government to kill American servicemen and women, and that's not acceptable.
The briefing comes as the president, who says he wasn't briefed on the information because it wasn't verified, is under increasing pressure to provide answers about the U.S. response to Russia, or the lack of one. Intelligence officials, including CIA Director Gina Haspel and Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe, will brief Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and top Republicans and Democrats on the two intelligence committees in a classified meeting on Capitol Hill this morning. Trump has called the intelligence assessments a hoax and insisted he hadn't been briefed on them because the intelligence didn't rise to his level. However, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said the CIA and the Pentagon pursued the leads and briefed international allies. Russian voters have approved amendments to the country's constitution that will allow President Vladimir Putin to stay in power until 2036. Election officials announced the results today after counting 100% of the precincts. Opposition leaders say the vote was rigged. Feature Story News' Lucy Taylor reports from Moscow.
With 99% of the votes counted, more than three-quarters approved changing the constitution. It means Vladimir Putin will be able to stand for two more terms in office. At the end of those, he'd be 84 years old. The changes were bundled into a single package of hundreds of amendments, but election monitors noted irregularities and say the votes cannot be called legitimate. Opposition leader Alexei Navalny says his supporters would never recognize the results, but would not protest for now because of the risks of the pandemic. Lucy Taylor in Moscow.
In an attempt to curb the spread of the coronavirus by individuals who may be asymptomatic, Federal health officials are planning to blitz test younger people for the virus. So far, the plans involved are in the states of Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. All three southern states have experienced recent surges in positive cases of the virus since the phased reopening of businesses. Governors of each state have expressed concerns about the virus being passed on by people under age 35. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Admiral Brett Girouard confirmed discussions were ongoing with health departments in each state. Communities in which the increased testing is expected to take place were not mentioned by name. Governor Gavin Newsom has rolled back reopening plans in 19 counties in California to the recent spike in the state's coronavirus inspection rates, Christina Onestad reports.
Governor Newsom's order closes bars and indoor operations in restaurants. It comes just days ahead of what is expected to be a busy 4th of July weekend for the state, with so many people cooped up with cabin fever. That's worried public health officials wary of gatherings in large numbers, noting the spike in coronavirus cases has often come from families and friends reconnecting since the state relaxed its stay-at-home orders. Newsom says the new rollbacks apply to 19 counties that have been on the state's monitoring list for at least 3 days because of increasing coronavirus infections. And it applies to more than bars and restaurants.
Wineries and tasting rooms, movie theaters, family entertainment, broadly defined by guidelines that we have previously put out, zoos, museums, and card rooms in this state.
The governor's also asking people who have plans to gather with friends and family during the 4th of July weekend to refrain from doing so to help mitigate coronavirus spread. I'm Christina Onestad, reporting for KPFA.
PG&E has emerged from bankruptcy. The announcement came yesterday, one day after Governor Gavin Newsom authorized a new law paving the way for the state to radically restructure the company if it fails to rehabilitate itself. The company said it has emerged from Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection after implementing the financial restructuring plan that was previously approved in court and by state regulators. As part of that process, PG&E has provided about $5.4 billion in initial funds to pay wildfire victims. The utility's equipment was blamed for starting the state's most devastating ever wildfire, which leveled the city of Paradise, California, last year. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to kick off our show today with our weekly Earth Watch. And I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Lauren Gifford. She is a human environment geographer exploring the intersections of global climate change policy, conservation, markets, and justice. Her work asks how and by whom climate and conservation policies are enacted. She teaches at the University of Colorado Boulder and Metropolitan State University of Denver, and she is a visiting researcher at the Environmental Justice Climate Justice Hub at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She conducted research on forest carbon offsets in Alto Mayo protected forests and in Peru, and used it as a case study in her doctoral dissertation. Dr. Lauren Gifford, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Margaret. Happy to be here.
Okay, so refresh our listeners who are totally confused about carbon offsets. Exactly what are they, and what is the problem with them?
Well, there's many different types of carbon offsets. I've particularly focused on forests that get included in climate change mitigation programs, and the Alto Mayo Protected Forest that I think we're going to talk about is one of them. So the idea is by preventing deforestation or replanting forests, we can contribute to sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So sort of mitigating climate change by protecting forests.
Right. Okay. So then let us get to the what we are going to be mainly talking about, which is the Alto Mayo Protected Forest and Disney. What's going on with that?
So the Alto Mayo Protected Forest is a RED project, a forest carbon offset project in north central Peru. RED stands for Reduced Emissions from Degradation and Deforestation, so reducing carbon emissions by preventing deforestation. It's a project that's been around since about 2008. I have been visiting there since 2012. It's largely sponsored by Walt Disney, and that's why it gets a lot of news coverage, because the program is used to offset the emissions from Walt Disney's cruise ships, which are incredibly polluting and dangerous for the environment, cruise ships in general. So the idea is that Disney made initially a $4 million investment, I'm sure it's been more over time, into protecting this vital watershed, the Alto Mayo Protected Forest, in northern Peru, as a means of maintaining and slowing deforestation in the region. But there has been incredible conflict almost since the beginning, but it's really ramped up more recently between the local communities who live in and around the Alto Mayo and the administrations who are applying the carbon offset management plan.
Right, and tell us a bit about the split in the community between people who are in favor of the project and people who are opposed to the project.
Right, so I think it's there's not a binary. It's not a direct split. There's many different perspectives and takes on what's happening and what's causing conflict. One of the main issues is that this protected area was not heavily managed as a protected area prior to 2008 because of lack of resources from the Peruvian government. So then once they apply the carbon offset project to this area, what we see is essentially it becomes a carbon management program. And that type of dominant governance regime in the Alto Mayo, and this is true in any place where we see a forest carbon offset project, but it's an example of what we often call carbon colonialism. So when forest carbon sequestration for climate mitigation is privileged above all other forest uses, it then deprioritizes other forest uses, other livelihoods, cultural uses, traditional industries, things like that, that rely on the forest. And a focus on forest carbon privileges the interests of the carbon offset developers over other forest users and interests. So there's other people who are living here, who have settled here, and there's communities of up to 5,000 people within this forest program, and they're suddenly told, you know, you can't deforest. You can't cut down trees for agriculture and logging and other activities. And they're saying, well, we don't recognize you as the leader here. We don't recognize you as someone who can tell us how to manage our land. So there's conflicts over who owns the land tenure. You hear this term come up a lot when we talk about forest carbon and any type of carbon offset, who has tenure and recognized rights to the land. So there's conflict over that. And there's conflict over people saying, you know, Disney and Conservation International, you can't come in and tell us how to behave in our land and in our place.
Yeah, I mean, complicated indeed. I mean, the cruise ships, as you say, very, very polluting. Disney, that doesn't have a reputation for exactly treating its workers in the mm-hmm. United States, paying a decent wage and et cetera. But you have these large corporations who could, put themselves forward as environmentalists and we're doing the right thing on the one hand, like Disney. Disney also very exploitative in factories in Haiti, where they are refusing to pay, not even $5 a day for people who are working there. But then you have this Disney basically saying they have a long legacy of caring about nature. They want to get to zero net direct greenhouse gas emissions. So I understand the complexity of the problem on the ground. And the other is, how sincere are companies like Disney? And should people be concerned when they say, well, we're for nature and we're, putting money into these carbon offsets that then can have a positive impact in terms of saving the forest, but then also up against the community living in the forest and on the land.
Right,
Dr.
absolutely.
Lauren Gifford.
It becomes an issue of or a tool for corporate social responsibility, which we know is often used as greenwashing for a lot of the reasons that you addressed. And sometimes I have wondered when I've been in the field and been in the Alto Mayo, like, why are we asking these poor farmers, these campesinos, to radically change their behavior when we could just, you know, spend more money on either not going on cruise ships, hopefully, but or greening the cruise industry and greening our electrical grid and things like that, you know, moving towards sustainable, renewable electricity, instead of aggressively asking really poor folks to change their behavior.
Yeah, and I mean, globally, there is a crisis of poverty. And, you know, I've found, I mean, talking with people, I'm from the Global South myself, from an impoverished village in the Caribbean. But increasingly, there is some discussion about you can't really fully address what is happening with the environment, saving forests in particular, without also looking at what is happening with poverty. In Haiti, mm-hmm. for example, you see people who are basically stripping trees of bark, etc., just so they can make charcoal so that they could make a little money. I mean, Haiti is the most impoverished place in the Western Hemisphere. So there is, I mean, it really is a fusion, isn't it? I mean, is it possible to really talk about environmental justice without social justice and economic justice? What are your thoughts on this, Dr. Lauren Gifford?
Right, absolutely not. Right. So we need to think about people and we need to think about social justice before we're going to get anywhere with environmental justice. We need to care about the people who are being exposed to toxins, who are being exposed to air pollution, who whose livelihoods are being squashed before we can, you know, appropriately address the natural environment. And one thing that's happening and why there's a lot of violence around this erupting in the Alto Mayo is because many of these people, they're small farmers, they're poor, they're young, and they actually believe that they had land tenure. They were sold the land by other people. So they believe that they own the land, and then they're, you know, another organization is coming in and saying, no, and actually you don't own this land. You need to leave or you need to behave in the way we want you to behave in this space. And that is in much of the root of the conflict.
Yeah, and I imagine, I mean, I know your focus is what is happening in this particular region, but given your work as a human and environmental geographer, there, you know, we see these kinds of conflicts, don't we? Not only, you know, in the region that you have focused on, but I was just reading about the killing, the dying of elephants in Botswana, which is very, very alarming. And the government was saying something like, well, we have to balance out, you know, how the resources that we're putting in to assist people as opposed to resources to fundamentally save the environment, including the animal world. It does seem as though there's a false distinction, at least from where I sit on this. And just give us some final thoughts, putting what is happening in Alto Mayo Protected Forest within this global discussion, really important discussion that's happening right now, Dr. Lauren Gifford.
Well, that's a great question, Margaret. I would say the details are specific and unique to a place, but the broad story is the same, right? And there is... capitalism is spreading and it doesn't want to bend, so investments are being made in places like the Amazon to offset things that are happening in South Florida and in the Caribbean. And I think we really need to address human rights and worker rights and look at the legacies of the environmental justice as a social movement, civil rights movement, workers movement, labor movement, and look at successes that have happened there and draw on them to address the conflicts that are arising from these new types of carbon development and climate change mitigation and problems that are coming from that.
Right. Well, Dr. Lauren Gifford, we appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we appreciate your work. We also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project, our partners, for our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. Dr. Lauren Gifford, thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are now going to bring you the voice of Mike Africa Jr., a member of the MOVE organization. He is a revolutionary, a conscious hip-hop artist, and a motivational, resilient speaker who pushes his revolutionary message with his stage performances, tackling issues such as mass incarceration, police brutality, environmental protection, systemic oppression. For those of you who may not know, MOVE, that based in Philadelphia, it's a Black liberation group founded in 1972 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by John Africa. The group suffered two major attacks by the Philadelphia Police Department, and by the way, the mayor at the time, Frank Rizzo, his statue was finally removed given the uprising happening across the country and huge protests happening in Philadelphia. Now, in 1978, a standoff resulted in the death of one police officer, injuries to several other people, and life sentences for nine members who were convicted of killing the officer. In 1985, another confrontation ended when a police helicopter dropped a bomb on the row house of MOVE. The resulting fire killed 11 MOVE members. Yes, that's right, 11 people. They bombed the house in a residential neighborhood, ordered by Frank Rizzo, the city of Philadelphia. That included five children, and it wound up destroying 65 houses in the neighborhood. Now, Mike Africa is the son of two political prisoners who were recently released from prison after 40 years. He was secretly born in a Philadelphia prison following a police raid on his family's home. He was taken from his mother and placed in an orphanage where he was physically and mentally abused. At age 13, Mike Africa began using his music to raise awareness in the hopes of gaining support to get his parents home. Finally, on June 16th, 2018, after 40 years in prison, Mike Africa finally got his mother released. And 4 months later, on October 23rd, he got his dad released. Let us go now to hear audio, the voice of Mike Africa Jr.
My name is Mike Africa Jr. I'm a member of the MOVE organization. And as a result of us protesting and fighting against this system, we've been targeted. Many, many, many times our family members have been beat by police, shot by police, jailed by police, put in prison for a year, decades. Our family was so heavily targeted by the government. At one point, the Philadelphia police flew a helicopter over our house and dropped a bomb on our house and killed 11 of our family members. People that were trying to escape the house, the police shot them back into the house. People that the house was on fire and burning at over 2,000 degrees. And when the people tried to escape the house, the police shot them back into the house. Some of the people that did escape the house were shot and thrown back into the fire. We have suffered many losses for our fight for protecting life, people, animals, and the environment. My parents spent 40 years in prison because of their stance against the system. 2018, for the first time in my life, my parents came home because of the fight and the unity that people have in them fighting for them to come home. The MOVE organization was founded in the early 70s by John Africa. The mission of the organization is to protect life and to encourage other people to protect life too. And when we say life, we're talking about people, animals, and the environment. As a result of having this belief and encouraging other people to protect life, we were targeted by the system and their officials,
the police, because when you are protecting life, what you're doing is you're extracting yourself out of the system and supporting it. At the time in Philadelphia, there was a very, very controversial mayor by the name of Frank Rizzo. He was known for his racism and his brutality against African Americans. And his police were used and militarized to attack, move people, and they did. And they attacked people, and they beat people, and the beatings escalated, and they would come to our house, and at one point they beat one of the pregnant women, and they beat her to the point where she suffered a miscarriage. And on other occasions, when MOVE people would get arrested, MOVE people would protest to get them out of prison, and we protested. We want justice. They didn't do anything wrong. They didn't break any laws. They're maybe 12 or 13 years old. You locked them up for nothing. We want our people home. And that led up to other things. And we couldn't get justice. It became very frustrating. So on May 20th, 1977, MOVE took a defensive stand. We said, we ain't going through this with you no more. If the police come at us, we're letting the people know we're going to defend ourselves. We got the right to self-defense. We got the right to freedom of speech. We ain't breaking no laws. And we're not accepting this. You're beating and killing our people. So that standoff is what led up to August 8th, because the police found a way to say that we broke a law by saying that our house had housing code violations. And when they said we had to leave the house. Now, we responded by saying, you haven't been in this house to say that it has housing code violations. We even let them inspect the house to prove that it didn't have housing code violations. But they said it did anyway, and their response and how they dealt with the housing code violations was to send 600 cops to the house and send bullets raining down on the people in the house, to send water from firemen's water cannons at the people in the house. That led to a police officer being shot, because when they were shooting, a police officer was shot. And of course, they blamed it on MOVE. So because of that, the people in the house went to prison.
And many people believe that fatal shot could well have been from law enforcement itself. Actually, I was reading that, or I've heard, maybe you could verify that, the judge basically said, we don't know where the shot came from, but since an officer died, there has to be consequences. And without knowing anything more than that, sentenced everyone to prison. Is that correct?
All nine.
So that's the MOVE 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe two of those individuals died in prison?
That's right.
Okay. And both your father and mother were sentenced. And there's still two men. Two women recently released?
Two women just recently released this past May.
Okay.
So Chuck was 18.
Okay.
Never spotted with a weapon, never seen to have a weapon. His
18.
Hands was checked,
yeah.
And he did not have a weapon. My dad was 22, my mom was 21. Janine was 21. Janet, I believe, was around 27. Merle was around 30-ish.
There's a story that you were born in prison. Is that true?
That's what they tell me. I don't remember.
You don't remember. But as the story goes, you were born in prison.
Right.
And your mother actually kept you concealed for several days or something like that?
That's what I hear.
Right. So both your mother and your father are now out of prison, correct?
That's right.
When did that happen?
So the release of them came under a lot of pressure from the people and different officials.
Okay.
And that just happened just last year.
Wow.
40 years. They both served 40 years.
And did you picked up your father from prison?
Both of them. I picked up my mom and my dad.
Why are you at the Forest and Climate resurgence, convergence.
I'm here because I was invited, and anytime I'm invited to do something that supports the environment or people's knowledge about the environment, I take the, if I have the opportunity, I use that opportunity to do that.
Okay.
The environment is, what are you gonna do without it, right? You're like, I don't care how sharp your speech is about revolutionary action against mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how bad you can talk about the importance of freeing the animals from cages. I don't care how sharp and wise you are about human trafficking. Whatever kind of revolutionary position you take, you are not taking without the environment. You need the air. And I don't care who you are or where you're from, how much money you got or how little, what color you are or what creed. If you don't have the air, you don't live. And that applies to everyone. People that are practicing environmental or even like community sharing, so that you don't have to get resources from some other place, you share the resources with each other, with your community, that's the biggest threat to the system.
It's a big system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it can crush people.
Yeah.
Is there any hope?
Is the system bigger than the planet? Is the system bigger than the amount of people that exist on the planet? Is the mentality of the system stronger than the need for the people's air? The system is not powerful. What it is it's like a parasite that depends on people to carry it around and be the host for it. But it is not powerful. What can the system do without people supporting and endorsing it? Think about the military. The military is a construct set up by the government to protect the country. But when you find out that the military, the branches of the military are actually invading other countries and this, that, and the other, right? Well, the military is big and it's powerful. And there's a lot of people, a lot of weapons and all of that. You've got boats, the ships that are sailed in the Navy. You got men on the ground fighting in the Army. You got the Air Force. Well, how many of those airplanes can fly without people flying them? How many of them ships can sail without people sailing them? How many men makes an army if there's no men for the army? And it's the same thing with the system itself. People support the system, and that's why the system exists. How do you stop the system? Stop it. Stop supporting it. Stop using it, and encourage other people to do the same thing.
What's your take on Black Lives Matter, Ferguson? I'm just throwing it out there. I mean, thoughts.
I think that police should stop killing people. And being that they can't stop killing people, they shouldn't carry guns. And if they can't control themselves, they shouldn't be on the police department. The police are supposed to serve and protect the people. It's not the other way around. Every movement is built. Every movement that exists and has ever existed is built and assembled because they're in opposition to some injustice. And the government is at the forefront of providing those injustices to people. And when Mike Brown was shot, that was bad enough. But when Darren Wilson was freed, that just made it worse. Mike Brown had bullet holes in the top of his head. If Mike Brown had been the killer of Darren Wilson, would Mike Brown have gone home?
I say there's unity, that the example of unity is present in the fact that my parents came home. The example of unity is present in the people that are here today. The example of unity is in the people that fight to support Standing Rock. the example of unity is important to understand when you're dealing with these politicians. If you expect hope from politicians, I will not tell you to not look at politicians for hope, but what I will say is look at the pattern. If things have gotten better, go with it. If they have not, there's your answer. Thank you for listening to me. And
all righty. And the voice you heard along with Mike Africo is Steve Taylor, who is with the Global Justice Ecology Project. He is their press secretary. And this discussion took place during the convergence that the Sojourner Truth team attended in Shawnee National Forest last fall. And Mike Africo was there. One of the things that Mike Africo has said is that, and just quoting it, he says, we don't believe in this reform world system. The government, the military, industry, and big business, they have historically abused, raped, and bartered life for the sake of money. These rulers and policymakers don't care who they kill, enslave, cripple, poison, or disease in their quest for money. They have made material wealth a priority over life. Marvels of science and technology, so-called advancements of all, stem from the system's greed for money and disrespect for life. But a person who is suffocating or drowning doesn't call out for diamonds, gold, or wads of money. The person will do all in their power for a breath of air, because air is a necessity and money is worthless. And as we are focusing on we can't breathe, and all of us trying to breathe, the words very, very well put. And again, we want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a station break, and when we return, we'll be spending the rest of the hour with Dr. Malina Abdullah with Black Lives Matter, Los Angeles for our Campaigners for Black Lives series. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
All we want to do is break the chains off, man. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off, man. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. Can you tell me why? Every time I step outside, I see my die. That could kill my soul. Oh no. Say, all we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free.
All righty. And that song becomes somewhat of an album, a mantra of the movement for Black Lives, that is Be Free by J. Cole. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are also heard nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Nashville, Tennessee. In Nashville, Tennessee. And internationally, yet again, France turning up as one of the top countries. We want to give a shout out to our listeners in France. But also, we're going to do two international shout outs today for our listeners in India. India showing up on the radar. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now we're going to go to our weekly campaigners for Black Lives. And I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Dr. Malina Abdullah, professor, author, community campaigner in Los Angeles, professor and chair of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and immediate past campus president and current counsel for affirmative action chair for the California Faculty Association, which is the faculty union. Now, Malina as I call her, also serves on the leadership team for Black Lives Matter and is committed to ending state-sponsored and police violence towards all people, and especially Black people, and she is a mom. Dr. Melina Abdullah, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Sister Margaret. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, Melina, what I'd like to do now is, I mean, you know, it seems as though you can't really do anything while Black without having to deal with the consequences of being in this skin. I just want to play a clip now of a Miami, Florida police officer punching a Black woman in the face. Let's go to that clip
now. Caught on camera, a dispute between a Miami-Dade officer and a woman takes a violent turn when the officer suddenly slaps her. The officer is now relieved of duty.
But the video has several top Miami-Dade officials seeing red and vowing to take action. CBS 4's Brooke Schaefer joins us live from Miami International Airport, where the altercation happened.
Hey, ladies, good morning. That disturbing video gaining a lot of traction on social media. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez calling it appalling. This body camera footage shows a woman engaged in a verbal argument with the officer when he suddenly and violently hits her in the face. Film director Billy Corbin first shared the video, which runs about 30 seconds. This happened at Miami International Airport. The woman was shouting at the police officer and got up close to him when he hit her. It's not known if the woman was injured or what the argument was about, but the woman could be heard telling the officer that he was acting white when he is actually Black. Those are her words heard in the video. A source tells CBS 4 News the officer is a 20-year veteran of the force. Miami-Dade's police director says he is shocked and angered and has relieved the officer of duty. Director Freddie Ramirez goes on to say, quote, actions such as these undermine the hard work that we have invested in our community and causes my heart to break for our community and for the vast majority of our officers who dedicate their lives to serving our county. This will not stand, he goes on to say, and I assure our community that any officer acting in this vein will be held to account.
You act like you're white when you're really Black. Don't walk on police if you're real. Hey, what you want to do?
He's also asking the state attorney to join the investigation. The video also grabbing the attention of Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, who retweeted Director Ramirez. He wrote, quote, this is appalling, it's excessive use of force and unnecessary. That's not what Miami-Dade police are trained to do. The mayor goes on to say Miami-Dade Police Director Ramirez has ordered the officer relieved of duty and an investigation is underway. This is why I instituted body cameras and Miami-Dade police are reviewing the footage. Right at the end of that body camera video, you can hear the officer say that the woman headbutted him. Again, late last night, the police director tweeting out that he has spoken with the state attorney and has asked her office to immediately join the investigation. I'm live outside MIA, Brooke Schaefer, CBS 4, this morning.
So, Melina Abdullah, this is just the latest incident that we know about. We know that there are many that we don't know about. And I was interested to hear that the Black woman was telling the police officer that he's acting white while Black. And, you know, a lot of people can't really wrap their heads around that in terms of institutional racism, that it can be implemented against people of color by other people of color. Any thoughts on that, Melina?
We have our very own example of exactly that right here in Los Angeles with Jackie Lacey, who is the district attorney who we always reminds us of Zora Neale Hurston's words that all skin folk ain't kinfolk, right? That there can be Black faces on white supremacy, and this is the way that oppressive institutions work. That it doesn't really matter who is moving the oppression, right? You can have people who are Black, people who are of color within oppressive systems moving that oppressive system, and that's still white supremacy, even though it's being advanced and forwarded by people of color.
Yeah, and for especially in this time, first of all, we know that the reaction from the chief of police in Miami would not have happened if it were not for this mass movement that has been on the street and also demanding the defunding of the police. Now, across the U.S., that movement, making waves, New York City Council has cut $1 billion from its police budget. That's reported by CNN. The New York Police Department, largest force in the country, Also on Friday, June 26th, the Minneapolis City Council approved a proposal to eliminate the city's police department, and they would remove the existing police department and replace it with a Department of Community Safety and Violence Protection that would be overseen by a director nominated by the mayor and approved by the city council. Dr. Molina, tell us about the efforts in Los Angeles with policing in neighborhoods and the streets, but also within the public school system.
Black Lives Matter has been moving to defund the police for the last 5 years, and of course that effort ramped up just before the murder of George Floyd, when we launched our People's Budget LA, finding that, you know, it's just, most people agree with us that it's just unacceptable for more than 50% of our city's general fund to go straight to LAPD, especially when we have such needs. So this effort, the People's Budget LA effort, was launched after we got the information about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on Black communities. And so we began asking Angelenos where they'd like their money to go. And overwhelmingly, people wanted their money to go to meeting the universal needs of people, to the built environment like parks and rec centers and libraries, and to really reimagining public safety and funding transformative justice practices and other community-based safety approaches. Their lowest priority was traditional approaches to public safety like police and prosecution and traffic enforcement. So this was launched back, you know, in April. And we began to push really hard around that. And then when George Floyd was murdered, of course, it gained momentum. And we've really been pushing around defunding LAPD and defunding LA school police, recognizing that if there's one place police do not belong, it's in our schools. So just over the course of this week, we won 4 major victories. One was announced yesterday that the LAPD budget would be cut by $150 million. And it sounds like a lot of money, but it's really not that much money. It's a drop in the bucket when you're talking about a $3.15 billion budget. But we have to embrace the fact that it's the people who made that happen, the people who made there at least be some reduction. The bigger victory, in my opinion, especially as the mother of 3 LAUSD school children, is a 35% cut to the LA school police, reduction of $25 million, and then the removal of police from campuses. So now police can only be on the perimeter of the campus, because the premise is that they're there to secure the school, not there to intimidate and traumatize the children. We had other victories that I think really represent this reimagining that we've been talking about. Motion approved that was introduced by Herb Wesson, Nuri Martinez, and Marquise Harris Dawson, which says that police should not be the responders to nonviolent emergency calls. So they want unarmed, non-police responding to nonviolent emergency calls. And we think about how that would have saved the lives of people like Rosario Mack and Jesse Romero and so many others. And then finally, Marquise Harris Dawson and Mike Bonin introduced a motion just 2 days ago that would remove police from responding to traffic calls, which, if we think about the ways in which they use pretextual stops, the idea that a broken taillight should be a reason to stop somebody and then is used to pull especially Black folks out of cars and sometimes leads to the deaths. I'm thinking about people like Keith Bercy and even more recently Daniel Hernandez, that the removal of police from these traffic calls is really a fundamental reimagining. So things are moving, and I think it demonstrates, you know, one of the chants we always make is when we fight, we win, and we're fighting and we're kind of raking in the victories at this moment.
A lot of people don't realize the various roles that police officers and even sheriffs play. You know, I've done a lot of work around child welfare and the unjust removal, particularly of black children, but children of color, not necessarily because of abuse, but because of poverty in a lot of situations. And often when social services turns up at a house to try to detain a child, they come with the police, right, or with the sheriffs. And that is really frightening for the mother or the primary caregiver, not to mention the children. And also, if children are detained from the school, right, sometimes even without the main caregiver being there, again, that is law enforcement. And I'm wondering if all of those kinds of roles that the police play in relation to child welfare, for example, if all of that is really needs to be looked at and some other way be found, including stop taking our kids because we're poor. Dr. Malina Abdullah.
What's happening, and I think this is a moment when the world is cracked wide open, right? What's happening is people are beginning to look at spaces not only of police defunding, but spaces of abolition. And when we talk about child welfare, it's really important that we think about how the presence of law enforcement really traumatizes the children that office is supposed to be there to protect. I think about, you know, situations that I've witnessed where, you know, the children are more traumatized by the presence of law enforcement, by the way in which law enforcement really criminalizes them. Than they are by the initial allegation of abuse in the first place. And so we need to think about spaces of abolition. Police don't belong, are not viable partners for a system that's supposed to protect children. Police don't belong in our schools. Police don't belong in our parks. One of the things that one of my dearest friends and comrades says is police also don't belong in places like Hollywood. So Kendrick Sampson has been moving to remove police from Hollywood sets, recognizing that their presence on sets actually is traumatic for black actors, and they don't belong there. And so I think that we can radically reimagine what public safety looks like. We can think about spaces of abolition like schools and child welfare systems and parks and traffic stops, but we can also think about our own neighborhoods. How do we become abolitionists in our own space? And when we say remove police from space, it's important to remember that we're not saying don't worry about public safety. It's saying that for black people, safety has never meant police. Police have been designed from the beginning to put targets on the backs of black people. And so for us, I don't know a black person on the face of this earth who feels safer when a cop car pulls up behind them, right? For us, public safety has always meant the building of black community. And so we need to absolutely divest, defund the police, and also invest in the building of black community. And that, what that means is getting to know our neighbors. I think about a Tatiana Jefferson where, you know, if they had had, and I feel terrible for the neighbor who called thinking he was helping, but now in a Tatiana's name, we can think about how do we make sure we know our neighbors, and if her door is open at 3 o'clock in the morning, then figure out how to go over there and make sure she's okay and she'd still be playing video games with her nephew rather than having been murdered by an officer, right? And so how do we build black community? How do we create spaces of abolition? How do we reimagine what public safety looks like, and how do we invest in those alternatives? And that's really kind of the work that lies before us.
Yes, and Malina Abdullah, tomorrow for our listeners, just a little preview here, we're going to be discussing black-brown history relations in the United States with a panel, a roundtable representing black people, Latinx community, as well as Native American, indigenous communities. And what I wanted to ask you about, that we see that these issues are not only issues within the Black community, but also in the Latino, Latinx, and indigenous communities. And we know recently, June 2nd, 22-year-old Sean Monterosa was fatally shot by a police officer at a Walgreens parking lot in Vallejo, California. Less than an hour before he was shot, he texted his sister a petition demanding justice for George Floyd, of course, who was killed by Minneapolis police a week earlier. And then on June 18th, also this year, 2020, 18-year-old Andres Guardado was fatally shot by a deputy sheriff near Gardena and West Compton. Andres, he worked two jobs and was a student at LA Trade Tech College. So how much coming together is there between the communities that are protesting around the deaths of these two Latino men with the Black Lives Matter
protest? So Andres Guardado's family was with us at the protest in front of Jackie Lacey's office last week. One of the most beautiful parts of this work is the real deep solidarity among communities. We work with indigenous folks, we work with Latinx folks in a very deep and non, you know, it's not a surface level interaction. We're working very deeply with the families. Normally, if you come to one of the Wednesday protests in front of Jackie Lacey's office, and it's every Wednesday in front of the Hall of Justice at 3 p.m., you'll see a significant number of Latinx families. And remember, even that division, that idea of Latinx or Black, is really a false divide, right? I think about the clear African ancestry in the family of Jesse Romero, who's 14 years old, when he was murdered by LAPD officer Eden Medina. And I listen to the family of Daniel Hernandez, who's been with us almost every week. And one of the beautiful things that they talk about is living in South Central Los Angeles and working with Black folks. Yesterday, the mother of Daniel Hernandez, who speaks no English, offered words, but then also offered the chant that we say when we say his name, and then ended the chant with Ashe. And so it's just a beautiful coming together, a recognition that Latinx folks can lift up Black folks, and we can also embrace our Latinx brothers and sisters in ways that really kind of honor true solidarity.
Right. On that note, we're out of time, but Malina Abdullah, next time we speak, I do want to get your views too on the call from the people of Haiti, peasants and other people in Haiti, to the Black Lives Matter movement here in the United States for solidarity with them. As you know, they're being killed and slaughtered back by a corrupt U.S. government. So we don't have time to discuss that now, but I'd be interested to know your views on that. Thank you so much, Dr. Malina Abdullah, and thank you for your work and also for partnering with us each week for our campaigners for Black Lives here on Sojourner Truth. Thank you. Take good care.
Absolutely.
Now.
Thank you. You too.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes, and today's audio engineer. I'd like to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org. Follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram at So True Radio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.